There are so many good friends visiting on this happy morning that I cannot welcome all of you by name, but it would not mean nearly so much to us if you were not here. I am deeply pleased that Robin turned over his own pulpit to someone else because he and Sean wanted to be a part of this day. And I am both pleased and grateful that our daughter Karen arrived safely on Saturday from a 7-day bike ride across Oklahoma. Her children came by a more conventional means and spent last week with us before settling down to life in Wichita again. We've had calls and letters of congratulations from friends of this church in distant places, but as you know, we did not announce an opening for the general public in Wichita, partly because we felt there would be quite enough of you who would not wish to miss this first day, and partly because we knew there would be some kinks to straighten out before strangers came to visit. As often happens when one builds a house, the kinks turned out to be more visible than we had imagined. You were greeted by some ingenious banisters in front of the church. We have something else in mind, and these are a last-minute concession to the city inspector. When you join us downstairs for refreshments in Fellowship Hall, you'll notice that the carpet didn't make it for that room, and the kitchen is still boxed up, and you've already seen that we didn't wait for grass and landscaping outside. But we were eager to be in this place, and we're much too happy to let a few missing items spoil the fun. We would have liked to enjoy what was meant to be the finishing touch in this room, a pair of 6-foot brass chandeliers with 3 matching sconces on each wall, but as it turned out, we accepted too easily the reassurances that they would be here in plenty of time. As that appeared less and less likely, we checked several times, and we were told they were on the truck, which turned out to be code for, we don't know where they are, but now that you've called, we'll look harder. And finally, a few days ago, when the architect pressed for a response, he was told, we've located your lights. They're on the dock in Spain. So, if the Basques behave and there is no strike, we hope to see them before the end of summer. Next week and in July, we'll have special ceremonies for dedication of the communion table and the pulpit and the font. And in September, we'll have another opening ceremony for the people in this neighborhood and in the city. We could spend all the Sundays in between simply thanking the men and women who have given to this church in a multitude of ways. But right now, I would like to express our gratitude to 3 couples who have provided last-minute items to help us be ready for this morning. Glenn and Juanita James for the cross and candle set on the communion table. Some of you will remember that in our all-church meeting to consider whether we might be able to build our own church, it was Glenn, speaking for the 2 of them, who stood up and made a promise which inspired the whole room. We also thank Bob and Kathy Wells, who provided from their heaven-sent stores the beautiful new baby cribs and swings and tables so that the nursery could function this morning. And finally, Keith and Frieda Russell, members of the choir, for their latest gifts to the church. They have been generous to the music program on other occasions, and I honored their request that there be no formal thanks. But I gave notice in advance this time that we would want to thank them for the gift of the 2 flower pedestals and the registry table in the foyer, all made to order by the pew builders to harmonize with the colonial architecture. Keith and Frieda, we thank you. One day last fall, when we had only a hole in the ground, Robin stood with me. He comes up often. Begin to realize, looking at it. And after a moment of silence, which is rare in his presence, he said, "Could you ever have imagined during the winter of your discontent in 1982 that this would happen?" It was purely rhetorical. He knew I could never have imagined a church at all, much less the kind of New England colonial church which is so appropriate for Congregationalists. So a couple of nights ago, as I sat for the first time in my office and listened to the choir rehearsing downstairs, I took some time off from enjoying the present to think about the mystery of our future. Will we last 10 years or 50 or 100? How many lives will we touch? How many children will we welcome into the world? How many beloved friends will we say goodbye to in the warm intimacy of this room? Where are the ministers who will stand here in years to come? And where are the people who will take your places to build on the dream you dreamed first? What will happen to this church? I know some of the things that can happen if we are not sure about what a church should be. Let me tell you about three case histories. 2 years ago, when a congregational church conference was held in Maine, we were briefly in a little town called Biddeford and saw on Main Street a building identified as the MacArthur Library. But the sign couldn't hide the fact that the red brick building was once a church, and a little checking proved that it had been indeed once upon a time the Pavilion Congregational Church. Now, if a church has to turn into something else, I suppose a library is not a bad thing. We may be uncertain about a lot of things, but we agree that knowledge is power. What we need, we tell ourselves over and over, is more knowledge. If we know what needs to be done, we can be trusted to do it. So if we have to choose between being good and being smart, we choose smart more often than not. We keep dreaming, in the words of T.S. Eliot, of systems so perfect that no one will need to be good. What a hollow sound that has right now. We've grown far faster in knowledge than we have in goodness. And we're wondering through all these United States if we hadn't better find our way back to more goodness. It is the church's job to help make people good, but it gets embarrassed often about insisting so much on ethics and decency, and decides it would rather be a house of information than a place of redemption. It holds seminars and discussion groups on all the current controversies, and that is pleasant and stimulating, but it is not the first order of business for a church. The first order of business is the creation of a community of love and forgiveness and the redemption of lives gone temporarily astray. We read in the university the poetry of Stephen Spender, who gave up his bright and genial paganism and found his way into the church. He explained it this way: what was unbearable was to think that there is no moral awakening that we creep from moment to moment, deceiving ourselves, sometimes guilty and remorseful, sometimes happy, but never knowing the answer, never seeing things as a whole. Paul was no simple zealot when he said, "If I hold in my mind all human knowledge and have not love, I amount to nothing." Not far from Biddeford is Kennebunkport, another of those main towns with the marvelous names. This one is George Bush's summer home, a place of elegant shops and vacation houses and studios of artists. On South Street, there is a green shingled shop called the Mission Gallery. And to watch sophisticated people come into that place is to recall the words of a modern American author: "Today, art is the religion of the educated classes. Today, educated people look upon traditional religious ties, Catholic, Episcopal, Methodist, Baptist, Jew, as matters of social pedigree. It is only art they look upon religiously." The words take on special force when you discover that Mission Gallery in Kennebunkport was once a church. Maybe it was some small church that sold out to find a bigger home, but the symbolism is still open. There are churches that turn into art galleries long before they sell, more interested in aesthetics than in the miracles of change in human life. We cannot justify worshiping here just because it is aesthetically pleasing. We must worship because there is something so deeply and irrevocably true about our commitment that this is the place from which we assess the rest of our existence. Otherwise, the church becomes a slave to culture and turns into a library instead of having a library as a helper, turns into an art gallery instead of using art as a part of worship, turns into a business instead of seeing money only as a means of advancing the kingdom. There is one other case history of a church that turned into something else, but we have to leave New England and come to New York to see it. At the corner of 6th Avenue and 20th, where stands what was once the Episcopal Church of the Holy Communion. It now is a bar and dance club. And when a reporter from the New York Times went to see it one day, this is what the guide said with a great deal more pride than sensitivity: "You come in right here, and the first thing you see is this plaque, which is left over from the church. Now, we're not tearing down this plaque. We're spotlighting it. We're not trying to be sacrilegious here. Over there will be a replica of a confessional booth, and that's where you'll pay your admission. The bar upstairs is going to be made out of old church furniture. And then you walk into the church itself, and that's the dance floor. You see that huge stained glass window with the picture of Jesus? Well, with the holograms and lasers, we'll be able to make it seem like that figure is walking around in the air." I think of a crusty old preacher from my childhood who predicted exactly that kind of future for any church that made entertainment a larger part of its agenda than sacrifice and discipline and a vision of life at its compelling best. He had a glimpse, even in that far off time, of the theme parks and celebrity appearances and showbiz worship spectacles and the breezy prayers that would be meant to keep latter-day Christians from having to face the dismaying persistence of darkness in the world. So behind me, on the wall, is the most important symbol of this church, a reminder of defeat and despair, of how the word of love came into the world and the world would not listen, of how the light came into the world and the world overwhelmed it with darkness. It is always so, for a while at least, in every life. And the cross is the true symbol of a place where you are reminded of the things you would prefer to forget. To forsake that mission is to lose the church's true life. And I ask your promise, beneath this cross, which I had the great joy of making with my own hands, that you will never let that happen. Amen.